similar theories, but they weren't the same relators. They each had their own different knowledge base.
It's either two different witnesses to the wrongdoing, but it's the same crime, right? It's fraud, waste, and abuse on the government. So that's what this whole case is about.
But the question is the relators litigating it all claim on behalf of the government and himself. If Biotronic wants to reach a settlement with the Sands on the QTAM claims like it did, it can dismiss all of the QTAM claims. But then it has to go to the government separately to negotiate a waiver of the government's claims. And Sands doesn't play a role in that. Sands did not
have those. I mean, the record shows a fair amount of communication, 26 hours of attorney time. God knows how many emails as between the lawyers for Sands and Bennett. On various aspects, I'm assuming,
but not over
waiver strategy, the terms of the settlement.
Not over the government's waiver, Your Honor. When it comes to false claims act cases, it's up to Biotronic, the defendant, to negotiate the waiver with the government. The relator does not play a role. So in this case, it's...
Clearly, the two individual relators were working in concert with regard to the ultimate resolution of the case. Why else would the government have carved out, in its quote unquote partial intervention, claims that only Bennett could bring but Sam could not? I mean, to me, that bespeaks Bennett trying to protect his rights so that Sam's settlement doesn't step all over Bennett's ability. Under the government action bar to pursue his lawsuit.
Sands actually cannot be a bar to Bennett's action unless there's a waiver of the government. If the government decides not to waive those claims, Bennett or anybody else can bring those claims. Sands agreed to a settlement of his QTAM claims, but the government's claims of the false claims act remained open so that Bennett, who had more information, better information and better position to litigate the Sam clinical studies can come forward. So what's the best case
that you're relying on to show that the district court heard in this case?
Well, Your Honor, this is a question of first impression. So, but you can look at it, and in the briefs we did a lot of work on the various cases that show when they use a present tense verb, and it needs a present tense component to that.
Is your question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did Sands allege that there was established sham clinical studies?
He did allege that, Your Honor.
So that allegation was made and the government intervened, right?
The government did not intervene on the sham clinical studies case. It did not intervene on those claims. And if I can draw the court's attention,
point out to me something in the record which says the government intervenes only on certain claims and not on other claims.
That's the reason.
The statute says it's substantially the same allegations or transactions as alleged in the action, and they were alleged in the Sands action. All claims were publicly disclosed in the federal civil or administrative hearing in which the government is the party.
Though, Your Honor, the government did not intervene on those in the record, Your Honor, in the record, in the judgment of dismissal and in the intervention, the government made it clear that they were not intervening on the non-covered conduct claims and that these were dismissed without prejudice. What the rule here would do, if you adopt the rule that the district court adopts, the government would never be able to personally settle and allow another day. That there would never be an abandonment of a claim that would allow somebody to follow up.
What I'd like you to do is cite me to some portion of the record which states expressly that the government is not intervening on the covered claims.
Yes, that is
that's what you say is that they don't intervene as to that claim when the government is not a party as to that claim.
Yes, Your Honor. If I could just one step back, Your Honor, in the Everglades College case that was cited in the supplemental briefs, in that, it was the 11th Circuit in May of 2017, Reed said, when you intervene for purposes of settlement, when the government intervenes for purposes of settlement, it's not to pursue a claim. It's contingent. And so, therefore,
the claim was all of the time and effort that the government has put into investigating the question.
Your Honor, the investigation of the Gantt claim is not what's an issue. What's an issue is this intervention and settlement. The fact that the government,
if we buy this theory of partial intervention, which I'm still having a difficult time accepting, I mean, it just seems to me it's a straight question of, is the government in or is the government out? And if they choose to settle the case by resolving part of the case and not the other, then it doesn't split the case into two pieces. It's just the government acknowledging, as parties frequently do, you know, we don't have enough to proceed on those other causes of action, but we'll settle the case by settling these claims.
I understand that you're concerned, Your Honor, but it is one of form and not of substance. And the reason why is because the False Claims Act case is a collection of claims. So some claims may be barred and some claims may not be. And in fact, if you combine them all, does not mean that the government is a party, it's not asserting. The legislative history that I went through on the 1986 amendment makes it clear that the reason for the government action bar is to not allow a relator to come forward and assert a claim that the government is already asserting. So if Sands asserted those claims in a case that ended the moment the government intervened, that is not the same thing as the government.
Well, I'm not so sure. I'm going back to Judge Payne's question. If we look at what Mr. Sands' allegations originally pled, if we consider the fact that the government spent 4 years trying to examine the evidence in support of all those claims, and then look at the fact that the government settled with Sands and dismissed his claims, why doesn't that meet the statutory elements for what the courts have called the government action bar to preclude Mr. Bennett from going forward with a subsequent filing?
The government did not settle with Sands. By trying, settled with Sands. And by trying, settled with the government.
You're not taking the position that the government wasn't involved in the settlement discussions with Sands, are you? That can't be right.
As I said, when a False Claims Act defendant wants to settle, it has two tracks. It has to negotiate the dismissal of the kidnap case with the relator, and it has to negotiate a waiver with the government.
Well, it's a tripartite settlement, is it not? Because the government is intimately involved in Sands and Biotronics, the negotiations as to how to resolve the case. This case is essentially being brought in the name of the king, right?
It is.
Okay. And the king is at the table in this case.
The king only joined certain claims, but it only joined those claims for purposes of ending it. And the government did not, the king did not join the claims that were dismissed without prejudice. It didn't want to resolve those. And what this rule would do, it would bar the government's ability to partially settle a case and to leave for another day. That is something that is contrary to what the statute
was as a result of the communications between Sand and Bennett, right?
No, it had nothing to do with it, Your Honor.
And I just say Sand and Bennett had no communications about the terms of the settlement that Sand was negotiating about.
They didn't have communications, but that's not the answer. That's not even the issue, Your Honor.
Everybody's talking about their 26 hours worth of meetings and flew, was it even a restaurant down in L.A. that they flew to have the meeting of plaintiffs' counsel? I mean, it looked pretty clear to me what was going on.
Whether or not the relators, should be communicating to each other, they should be saying, this is your claim now, I might have an interest in it because they have a shared relationship.
Let me ask you this question. If Mr. Bennett had not dismissed the case that he had previously filed before the settlement,
yes,
he would be barred, would he not?
He would not be barred. He would be barred on the cover conduct, but not on the cover conduct.
Right. Let's hear from the government. I let you use up all the time, but I'll be here with some time because I have some questions for Mr. Hamilton.
Thank you. Please, the court, Edward Mulford with the Department of Justice representing the United States Amicus Curiae. I think probably the first thing I should do here is explain why I'm here.
why the government is engaged in exporting us. I think we may have gotten the real signature. We think that the correct interpretation of the government action bar 3730E3 is that based on the use of present tense language, it refers to pending U.S. notification.
Case that you take the position to
would you take the same position after the settlement that the government is no longer a party to the case?
After the case is dismissed, well, for purposes of the statute, there's a substitute that we do not take a position on whether that means that you're a party for all purposes or a substitute.
Okay, so then I'll ask my question hypothetically without regard to your status as a meeting here. Let's assume the facts as we have before us that Sand gets settled, the case gets dismissed. But for some reason, the government later wants to come back and ask the district court to reopen the case. Wouldn't the government be asserting at that point that it was a party in interest to this lawsuit and therefore it had standing to ask the district court under Rule 60 to reopen the judgment?
Well, I mean, that's a difficult question.
It's a simple question. I mean, I think the answer has to be yes. Otherwise, the district court would say, "Governor, it's always nice to see you in court today, but I don't have any reason to be."
But the ordinary course, the case is dismissed. The case is no longer for purposes of the government action bar. The case is no longer active. The way that the language works, it's allegations and transactions which are the subject of a civil suit or administrative proceeding.
But you don't dispute that at the time that the government first looked at this action, I'm assuming Mr. Sand sent the department a copy of this complaint because it's in this file, and then you made a determination to initiate an investigation into the allegations. It's been 4 years
for
interviewing witnesses, looking at documents, meeting with the company. I mean, that's pretty active involvement in the litigation, and then ultimately you enter an appearance in order to resolve a portion, or as you say, the suit. So at that point, why are you would concede that when the government was a party?
Absolutely.
To the same.
Absolutely. The case, the whole idea behind the government action bar is while the government is involved in the litigation, no other relator can be involved. There's no question about that. That's our position. Refers to cases that are ongoing.
And you would agree with Mr. Friedman's concession that had Mr. Bennett not dismissed his action, the original action, he would have been barred from refiling or claiming after the Sand case was resolved under the second exception.
Well, the first file of the Sand case was ongoing, so that was still barred.
So Bennett saved himself from that initial by voluntarily dismissing his lawsuit and then refiling it after the settlement, right?
Yeah, but just to clarify what I was trying to say about what the government is about, we don't take a position on the merits of his lawsuit. We don't take a position on whether any other grounds for dismissing his lawsuit is under class. It's under six grounds reasonable. And the district court gave this one and only this one. We think the district court got this one wrong. It's a misinterpretation of the statute.
Is it that we don't think he was either applying the word pending to E3?
No, not necessarily. No, we're applying the same concept of this pending.
Correct.
The concept of that
soft way of saying yes.
Well,
for the other word pending, but on the other hand, Congress used automatic pending.
That's correct.
Where they use, so I have to read Mr. Garner and Mr. Scalia's book very carefully to come to the conclusion that Congress uses a word in one part of the statute and doesn't use the same word in another part of the statute. It means it has a meaning. And in this case, it excludes pending under E3 and inserts pending under B5. How do you square that with our usual method?
Well, that's all very true, except for the fact that look at the language itself. The language is present tense language. There are several Supreme Court cases that say the present tense language means the present or future. The dictionary act of the statute of Congress says that present means continue the past, and that's what we base on. Also, there's another factor in this, which is we look at the language as part of the CFPB-3 formulas and bars in which the government is already a party. Now, if you want to include cases in which the government has been a party, but it's not a party because the case is over, that's not a legitimate way of saying it in English. Let me give you a colloquial example. Somebody comes up to you and says, Joe is already at breakfast. You say, I can't be. I saw Joe right out in the hallway right here. He said, no, I meant Joe's already at yesterday's breakfast. We don't talk about that. The use of this already a party necessarily means that the case has to be ongoing. Once the case is over, let me give you another way of looking at it also. Look at the overlap between the public disclosure bar and the government action bar. If you look at the history of it, it's also about that particular case very carefully. Before 86, you have some things referred to as the government knowledge bar. It's not that it's too risky, but Congress made it the public disclosure bar with an exception added for original source.
You would agree with that? I'm sorry, go ahead and finish your
sentence. I was just going to say that once you get, if you can get by the original source and public disclosure bar, then you're a preferred relator, you're not a parasitic relator, you're still barred under government action bar. Now, we understand personally why Congress would have wanted you to be barred, non-parasitic relator to be barred from while the government is litigating. That makes perfect sense because it interferes with our enforcement of the statute. But there's no reason that you need to continue the bar past the time when we're done with the litigation.
But wasn't Congress concerned about I'll call it the piling on of relators in a situation like this where the allegations had been made by the first relator and then number two wants to come along after number one has filed his action and make the same allegations and try and go after the defendant for more money?
But we're talking about a different situation.
Well, the district court, I think, was handling it by the fact that she thought Mr. Bennett was parasitic.
Right. I think what happened in the district court, and you know, it's hard to keep the cat's mind, but I think what happened in the district court is the court really thought that Mr. Bennett didn't satisfy the public disclosure or original source bar.
Well, the allegations were almost identical. This is a question of each player had to find the different evidence.
I think it's a judge of honor with that. This is an easier way of getting at the case. This is a second of a position on whether he satisfies the disclosure bar or not.
Well, why did the government resolve the same case in the way that it did if it wasn't in order to preserve Mr. Bennett's own?
Well, it was definitely in order to preserve the possibility that other relators with additional knowledge of the related frauds that it doesn't cover by the settlement agreement could come forward with
it. But the frauds that were covered by the settlement agreement were all of the allegations in Mr. Sands' complaint. At least as to him, he's barred.
Mr. Sands is barred, absolutely. Mr. Sands is barred. The relators are not barred because of
the voluntary congressional intent, because it seems to me that one of them, I can understand from a financial incentive why the government wants to have Bennett's cake and eat it too, and the hope that maybe they get more money down the road out of biotonic when relator number two comes along. But how does that comport with congressional purpose in enacting these bars to prevent sort of seriatim lawsuits under the QTAM system?
There are two other bars that also could apply. In a particular case, you can have the first filed bar, depending on the
incentives or the first filed
bar. Right, that's the incentive plaintiff.
Right,
and you can have the public disclosure bar.
I guess what I'm asking you, Mr. Goldfarb, is why is it the obvious reason you're hoping that we might be able to get more money in the future? Why is the government conducting itself in this fashion, given the congressional purpose in enacting these bars in the first place? It seems to me that the government is acting contrary to what Congress intended.
Well, I think the way we discussed this in our brief, and we talked about the different kinds of situations in which the government, the first relator comes to the government with information, gave fairly good information about one particular fraud, whether it's one contract, one defendant, or, you know, but vague allegations about other related ones. the government investigates.
But these were pretty specific allegations. I mean, there were allegations that the doctors were receiving money by being entertained at expensive restaurants, and they were being caught on medical advisory boards that they got paid for, but they didn't have to do any work for. I mean, these are pretty clear theories of fraud, waste, and abuse.
I understand that, but just to clarify, we don't take a position on whether Mr. Bennett's allegations would satisfy this. What we're trying to get the court, what our position for the court is, this action so far applies while the government is litigating, but not after the
litigation. Well, here's a broader question. I don't know if the section that you work in does more than just KTM cases.
It does.
Is there any other type of civil suit where the government takes the position that it is partially intervening and it's only partial party?
Well, because of that case, to clarify, we don't take a position on this statute talks about the Supreme Civil Suit. And Mr. Bennett takes a position that the government is a party, only a party. We don't have that position. That's not our position. We don't have that common intervention. It is a partial intervention. If you look at the cases like the Morocco case, the Supreme Court, this Florida Supreme Court accepts the idea that the different claims in the case, some of that may be justified, some of them may be satisfying the bar, some of them not satisfying the bar. But so how do you attack this case? I'm sorry, this case. We didn't do what? A partial intervention. Well, we did have a partial intervention. We intervened on some claims. We took over the claims. I think in the context of the False Claims Act, we talk about intervening. It may be a little bit different concept from
what that's done. That's what we're addressing. Is partial intervention, to the extent that that's a meaningful term at all, unique or sui generis to CTO actions?
Well, I think this way of doing it, I don't know if you need that.
Case in which the government is a party to civil litigation, and we get, I mean, the government has lots of different interests, as you know, and lots of different civil cases, but I've never heard him take the position that they only have one foot in the case as opposed to both.
Well, it has to do, I mean, again, I think it may be confusing. It's called, did you refer to it as that? But that's the phrase to refer to. Normal false claims.
I just think it is writing an opinion that says there is no such thing as partial intervention. So we put a stop to this legal question that I just don't see has any basis in law.
Well, that would be a little bit problematic for us. That's what I have to say.
I understand. I'm trying to take your position to the extreme here to understand how far you want to push it, really.
If I could just get back to I know I'm over time.
That's okay. I just need to say it's just a case and it's an intriguing issue.
Just to reemphasize, you know, you have the related suit satisfy the public disclosure bar and our non-parasitic deeds bar. Nevertheless, because A3, the international bar, seems broader than the public disclosure bar. So they bar all of the cases pending, but there's nothing in the statute that suggests that they should continue to be barred. There's no reason for barring them after the time that the government has stopped pending. And again, we take no position on the merits of the suit in this case. We're concerned out here solely to talk about the government's reputation. There's nothing to be said to end the file.
Say it brings a charge of saying Biotronics took him to dinner at expensive places, put him on phony advisory boards, began phony clinical studies, right? In general. The government intervenes. They find out that he got proofs to the first two, but not as to the third. But when they intervene, so they say we're only intervening partially as to the first two. Which, if they found evidence as to the third one, they would have gone forward on
it. Yes, but it's not ordinarily, not necessarily, but it's always
we have to intervene as all claims. And in the investigation, one claim falls out. If you intervene as to that claim, only so you can get discovery on that claim, you can enforce depositions on that claim,
they might have technically. Government doesn't intervene until the sentence is changed. You can't really, all the investigation is done under the False Claims Act. If through an informal mediation.
It seems that it could be done in a normal private party civil action, but it would require the formal use of the discovery tools of interrogatories, requests for production of documents, and depositions. But the government has broader powers in terms of its investigative resources. It's doing exactly the same thing that a party plaintiff to a case would do in order to flush out the evidence in support of its allegations.
And the government's idea is to find out where the fraud actually occurred, and then to take over the case to the extent that wants to enforce them under the fraud.
Implicitly, at this concept of partial intervention, is that it seems to me that it is a legal fiction that may be attended to the key TAM statute procedurally, but as a matter of substance, the government is behaving from the day that it decides to investigate the matter as if it already were a party plaintiff to the lawsuit, even though it has not formally intervened.
Well, there's some clarity short of what is an opinion
pretty much identical in terms of trying to figure out what the facts of the material. I understand the fact
that you can contend that the important thing is the government, by a settlement, is specifying which claims is lawsuit dismissed with prejudice, which things wants to be open for somebody else in the future. And in the
other case, it isn't all that different from a private party settlement where a party conducts its discovery and decides at the end of the discovery that I can prove claims 1 and 2, but I can't prove claims 4, so let's settle this.
Issue civil investigative demands, it's going to interview employees, it's going to demand all of the work product and time for counsel responding to these allegations, then why do we need to have, we practically won't see the government coming back at a later point in time and trying to reassert those claims.
Tell me why a punitive defendant, like Biotronic, would have to ever agree to settle on research. Why wouldn't our hypothetical defendant simply fold its arms and say, we want a complete global release of all claims so that we don't find ourselves in the situation where we are today and trying to figure out whether there's anything left for the second relator to pursue?
Certainly, and the government will have to speak a little bit more to its own policy on why it seems the way that it does, but to the extent that the government is not including claims within or allegations within the covered conduct, it's been our experience that they typically will refuse to dismiss those with prejudice. And so if the parties are interested in a settlement resolution, then you're left with this position by the government.
So is your answer, if we're going to get any settlement at all, we have to accept that term because they won't agree to anything other than dismissal without prejudice?
I think that that is a very real possibility, and we see that. And the other option would be to go forward at trial, and that's a risky proposition for defendants as well, with exclusion and debarment, and then at that point you're facing double damages, whereas typically if you settle, the government tends to go down a little bit on their damages provisions. So there's
the statutory penalties of what is it, 1,000 per claim or something?
It's a little over 11,000 per claim.
11,000
per claim. And so here, having the government action rule apply to past cases makes a lot of sense in terms of preventing the opportunism that Congress sought to prevent. And I wanted to make a point about the intervention question that you raised earlier. If we just look at the statutory provision within itself, we see that it talks about subjects, allegations or transactions which are the subject of a suit or proceeding.
Which is
I'm sorry, reading from E3 from the government action rule. And it says, suit or proceeding in which the government is a party. That term is not subdivided into allegations or claims. And had Congress wanted to subdivide that provision, it could have done so, and it did so in the amended public disclosure bar.
Your position is that we should look at the allegations that Mr. Sand raised in his complaint, and that's what should drive the inquiry.
The suit in which the government intervened is a suit in which those allegations are made. Yes.
And the same allegations are being made by Mr. Bennett with regard to other aspects of the growth that the government chose to pursue.
I think that would be Mr. Bennett's interpretation of his complaint, but if you look at Mr. Bennett's conduct over the past almost 10 years at this point now, is that he filed his first complaint in 2010, shortly after the Sand complaint, and during the government's four-year investigation, he amended his complaint three times, and then when he realized that the government was not going to intervene and recognizing the first trial bar would kick in, he then voluntarily dismisses.
Did he amend during the pendency of the government investigation by virtue of information provided to him by Mr. Sand?
Well, and that's where I was going to go, Your Honor, is that if you look at his now complaint in 2014, his complaint is a recitation of his prior complaints. It imports information from the Sand complaint, and the only additional information that is added in there is publicly available information about the clinical studies on, for example, the NIH, National Institutes of Health website. And so, we overlay that with the understanding that Mr. Bennett's employment with the company ended in the spring of 2010. And so, any sort of inside information that he claims to have had, he either should have provided to the government during his first complaint or any one of his subsequent two complaints.
What did we have here, which was a little unusual, as a result of the attorney fee dispute, is that we actually have the time records of the lawyers. So you can see that there was a lot of time spent between Bennett and Sand's lawyers throughout the course of the four-year litigation.
first the res judicata position, but if you also look at the scope of Mr. Bennett's complaint here in 2014, you see that that complaint is narrowly crafted within the contours of the settlement agreement, but that settlement agreement was not yet public. It was still under seal, and so therefore Mr. Bennett had to have had inside knowledge about the settlement proceedings that were going on. So even if we didn't have the time records, I think that there's sufficient evidence to recognize that Mr. Bennett was involved.
That's a pretty good description of what they were talking about.
This is true.
It wasn't the weather.
This is true.
Okay, well, I'm sure that
I
do
know if this matters.
We don't disagree with that, Your Honor. That's correct.
So why shouldn't
that happen? This particular rule was aptly applied. The government's reading and Mr. Bennett's reading to say that this is a pending action simply because there are the terms are and is in the provision would make an absurdity of an overly strict grammatical interpretation. And courts can and do refer to suits that have been dismissed and say that the allegations are the subject of that suit. And as you pointed out, Judge Tallman, we refer to participants in an action as parties even for matters post-judgment. So we see in Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 4, for example, it says is a party, and we refer to what rights they have. And if you look at the Supreme Court's interpretation of that particular rule under Eisenstein, that's the distinction. Is the government a party or is it not? Like you said, are they in or are they out? And just because that they are a real party in interest does not trigger their rights as a party, particularly under Rule A, until they intervene. Partial intervention or not, you are a party to that suit.
That's
I would agree with Mr. Bennett that it is a matter of first interpretation as to whether or not this particular rule is an ongoing or only a temporary requirement. However, if you look at all the other courts that have considered application of the rule, their primary focus is on what we would argue are the two primary questions in the rule. Are the transactions and allegations the subject of the suit? And is the government a party to that suit? And you can see this particularly in the Costner case out of the Eighth Circuit. In that case, the government action started and ended well before the litigation, that issue in the key text suit started. And there are district court cases along the lines. In the other cases that were cited, we see where there is a cessation of the original government action during the pendency of the TTAM bar. And since this is a subject matter bar, then the court still considered the application of the rule because it had, even though it had expired. And so, if we're looking to see what is the import of the rule, we do want to see where does it play in the statutory scheme that Congress has set up, and that is most effectively applied if you consider it to be more than just a temporary ban.
Counsel, just as Singer says, are you aware of any other analogy in civil litigation where the government partially intervenes?
I'm not, and if you look, Your Honor, to 3730C, that provision of the statute makes clear that the government is intervening in an action, and it is their primary responsibility for prosecuting that action. And so we recognize that the United States is in the best position because of the various rights that you've mentioned with interrogatories and the effective mini-proceeding that it's engaged in prior to its decision to intervene. And at that point, we have made the decision to enter into the action, and we now have primary responsibility. Even in the cases where there is partial intervention, you still have the government's ability to restrict the relator's participation. They can settle and dismiss all over the relator's objection, and
after they intervene.
There's some authority, Your Honor, to say that they don't necessarily need to intervene in order to settle or dismiss.
Right, but if there were an objection by the relator, wouldn't they have to intervene in order to settle and dismiss? Because there are
someone in the False Claims Act that allows for an aggrieved relator to challenge the settlement of the suit, and that's through a separate fairness hearing.
Fairness, what we see in class action.
Right.
Litigation when an objector files an objection.
Right. Well, in here, if Mr. Sand had felt that he should be able to proceed on the other claims that he made in his suit, he could have challenged the government's decision to negotiate this resolution against him with prejudice, but he didn't do so. And so, Your Honors, with respect to this concept that you're negotiating with only the relator or only the government that Mr. Manoos, the counsel, was speaking about, that wasn't the case here. We negotiated with, excuse me, Brown-Trying negotiated with the government in order to come up with the resolution that it did after the four-year settlement. Now, if it had been the case that it can't happen, that you negotiate with the relator and you negotiate with the government is still involved on this side to decide whether or not it will approve of the settlement. The government is still required to approve of all settlements under the False Claims Act. And so there is this concept that you only negotiate with the relator and you only negotiate with the government is a bit of a falsity. I also wanted to make...
You said that there's a statute which allows the relator to challenge the settlement as being unfair. I suppose the relator might say, well, the government doesn't think the evidence is strong enough, but I think it's strong enough, and I want to proceed on that. Is that how we would do it?
Yes, correct.
What is that statute?
Your Honor, the, I will reach out and get the statutory. Section 3730C2B, it says the government may settle the action with the defendant, notwithstanding the objections of the person initiating the action, if the court determines after a hearing that the proposed settlement is fair, adequate, and reasonable under all circumstances. And so it's through this fairness hearing that we see the evaluation by the courts of the hearing. Your Honor, I see my time is up. Happy to continue. Thank you. The Everglades case that we raised on the 28J letter speaks to this issue of whether or not it's fair to settle cases over the relator's objections. And it has an interest to this particular case as well. The government here investigated for 4 years and did a tremendous amount of work in furtherance of its decision whether or not to proceed. And it chose a resolution of the matter. And when we give deference to the settlement decisions under the 3730C provision that I just read to you, those same sort of concepts would apply to this action here in the sense of the government has acted, our primary prosecutor has acted here, and they have come to the resolution that they have decided is fair, adequate, and reasonable. And those considerations go beyond what a typical relator might try to do, which is maximize recovery. They may not want to bankrupt their primary contractor, and they might view the proportionality as different than the relator does. And importantly, there may not just be any merit to the relator's underlying claims, and the government is in the best position to decide that. So when it decides to settle a case with or without prejudice, even if they settle without prejudices to their own claims, they know whether they're in the best position to come forward on their own behalf. They don't need a relator to do so.
There's an indication here that they might bring in some ways and further resources to come on investigating the cases instead of consideration.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if you look at the key term statute itself, the Attorney General is under an obligation to evaluate every key term action that is filed. And so if we have this out of the line of relators that are constantly coming in trying to pick up the pieces wherever a settlement might have left off, the government is required to investigate all of those cases and keep track of them. Mr. Hamilfarb's here today because the government is keeping an eye on all of these cases that is going on. And so it is a continued waste of resources even after a government action has been settled.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, Mr. Freeman, I'll give each of you a couple minutes.
of the record where there is an intervention only for purposes of settling those claims and declining interventions, ER 47 and 48, and specifically on page ER 48. This last point about whether or not Sands could have objected to the settlement is absolutely wrong. Sands would not object to the government's decision to dismiss without prejudice some claims. Sands would simply, if he wanted to litigate and get more money, Sands would have simply not agreed to dismiss the non-cover conduct claims.
But you're not saying that the statute doesn't give him the right to make objection if he doesn't think it's a fair and adequate resolution.
The statute gives the right to the relator to object to the terms of the settlement, but it doesn't give the relator a right to object to the government's decision to leave certain claims open without prejudice.
Well, he has the right to object to any of the terms,
doesn't
he? You're saying as a practical matter, no relator ever would because it's leaving a part of the case open.
It's an issue here. You're exactly right, Your Honor. What's an issue here is Biotronic. It's not Santoli.
But this might suggest a nefarious motive for doing that, and that is that Sands and Bennett are in cahoots. And so there might be a situation where Relator 1 does file an objection in order to protect the interests of Relator 2.
No, Relator 1 would not file an objection over the decision to leave for Relator 2 the right to pursue that action. So Relator 1 and Relator 2 are speaking to each other.
Suppose Relator 2 didn't like the dismissal with regard to some of the claims that seem compromised.
If the government's compromised its claims, Relator 2 is simply out.
Right. But my hypothetical assumes that Relator 2 didn't like some of the terms that Relator 1 was otherwise willing to agree to, but for the collusion between the two relators and trying to maximize their recovery.
I'm worried about the certain collusion, Your Honor. I think
relator cases recognize it, right? We've got these DC cases where there was a lot of communication.
There is a lot of communication, Your Honor. There's nothing wrong with it.
I'm not suggesting
the relators are supposed to work together so we can help enforce the government's rights. And one relator may have a better claim than another.
Subject to the limitations that Congress has imposed, subject to statute.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. I'd like to close by pointing to there were a couple of questions raised and an argument made that the purpose of the government action bar is to stop parasitic lawsuits. That's absolutely wrong. Parasitic lawsuits are addressed in E4, not in E3. And in fact, there's no original source exception to the government action bar. There's no original source exception. So how could it be that the government action bar is about parasitic lawsuits on other relators, follow on other relators? There's also this question about why the relators
are you're overlooking the legislative history, which I assume was informed by objections by defense contractors in particular, that they didn't want to have to be constantly litigating as seriatim PTM actions brought by follow-on relators. Isn't that what caused Congress to enact these provisions?
I'm not overlooking it, Your Honor. I read through that legislative history several times, including for this brief. There's nothing in the legislative history that indicates that the government action bar is aimed towards parasitic lawsuits. What it is, it's a race to the courthouse. And you have to get there before either the government or another relator gets there. But once that case is dismissed, in fact, the Supreme Court in Carter says, why would Congress want to bar a subsequent valid lawsuit after the government has decided to dismiss without prejudice? And the court is clearly struggling with this personal intervention issue. Maybe this will help. It's not that dissimilar from another litigation where it's not about intervention, it's about the settlement decision. Let's say the government did intervene on all of Sands' claims, 1, 2, and 3, and it decides that they have enough evidence on 1 and 2 to get a settlement. But 3, there's a dispute. Biotronic doesn't want to pay. The government thinks it should have to pay more. So the government dismisses without prejudice to number 3. That's just like any other litigant. Any other litigant can say, I'm going to settle this claim, but not this claim. So the question is, if the government decides not to settle a claim, can another QTM creditor come forward at a subsequent time and take those claims?
Well, if it arises out of the same transaction, Congress has given us an indication that maybe number two cannot pursue
the other E4. Not under E3.
Okay.
Under E4, we would win. And if you remand it like Judge Sutter suggests, we will win on the original source issue because Bennett is not a parasite. He's somebody who's coming forward to enforce claims that have not validity. The government dismissed them without prejudice. The Biotron agreed to that. Biotron could not give the government to release those claims. Now Bennett's going to have to do it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Goldberg, do you have anything further? I don't have any here from you. If you do, I don't want you to feel like you left the courtroom and we didn't listen to you. Very well, the case is already dismissed and it will be adjourned. Thank you all for bringing this hearing.